I have a bias. I am absolutely, positively, 100% biased against sex offenders. And I will always err on the side of incarcerating someone who victimizes a child.
Does anybody really need to be told don't sexually abuse children? What they need are standards, and what they most need are heavy prosecutions. These people need to be tossed in the deepest, darkest cell in the world and sat there for years until they understand and are a deterrent for everybody else who's engaging in this conduct. But that never happens. That's the problem.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with us today from London is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague. I have a real interest in real crime and these minds that solve these crimes.
And with us today, a very special guest in studio is...
Hi, it's Francie Hakes. I'm a former state and federal prosecutor specializing in crimes against children.
So today we have Francie here, who's my co-host on Best Case, Worst Case. And we have Francie is going to talk to us about cases like the ones that we've discussed in The Keepers, prosecuting child sex crimes cases. Can you tell us what your experience is in that area?
Sure. I've prosecuted a lot of child sex crimes cases. I've had hundreds and hundreds and even thousands of cases of child sexual abuse and child physical abuse. The cases are very difficult to prosecute. There's no question about it. It's unlike any other crime. If you think about, for example, a bank robbery or a car theft or a carjacking or someone who is robbed at gunpoint on a street corner, nobody ever really doubts whether those crimes have happened. There's most often lots of evidence, either eyewitnesses, video surveillance, physical evidence, things are missing. But when it comes to prosecuting child sexual abuse and child physical abuse, cruelty to children, it's different. There is always a dispute. The offender says either the crime didn't happen. In the case of a child homicide, for example, there's always a dispute about whether it was an accident. That's almost never the case in an adult murder case where an adult is stabbed or shot or beaten to death. Everyone agrees there's a dead body. Someone must have done it. It's not a natural cause. But when you have a child death, especially, you have a dispute about whether or not there was some kind of accidental interference. Did the child fall? Was the person who has been accused of murdering the child actually just the one watching the child while some terrible accident befell them? And the same is true for child sexual abuse. There's always a big dispute about whether there was actually a crime at all.
Well, can you imagine if the only witnesses that we ever had to any other those other crimes that you mentioned were children? It would be very difficult because obviously some kids are pre-verbal. Some kids are under the age where they understand the truth and lies and are swearable. And they certainly don't have the language to describe some of the things that happened to them. And so for all those reasons, it makes prosecuting child sex crimes a very difficult endeavor. I know when I was a prosecutor, it was a very difficult type of case to put together. And even when I became an FBI agent, I continued to work in the area of child sex crimes. And what we did in the FBI to try to maximize the chances of getting justice and convicting child sex offenders was we always tried to find out if there were other victims.
That's right. Other victims can be very significant in assisting the prosecution of a case. I've tried many child sex crimes where there were multiple victims. Sometimes, even often, because of statutes of limitations, I know you've talked about that issue in particular here on Real Crime Profile, have prevented charging an offender for a prior crime. But that doesn't mean that that prior crime can't be brought in as what's generally called similar transaction evidence. And in fact, the first case that I ever prosecuted, Jim and I have talked about it on our podcast, Best Case, Worst Case, was exactly that. We had a 10-year-old little girl who had made allegations against her father for many years that were disbelieved. Once her mother and father got divorced, however, the mother pursued the case with the police and the prosecutors, And I was assigned the case and discovered that about 15 years prior to this child's initial allegations, her stepsister had also alleged that their common parent in the household, the man, had abused her as well. And so while the statute of limitations had run on the now 21-year-old girl, I had her testify as a witness, and she talked about how that man had abused her in almost exactly the same way that he had abused her little sister.
Right. I was going to say, we had a listener who had a very similar situation. She was abused by her father and was not able to come forward, but then years later, and thought he had stopped abusing, and then years later, he abused his grandchild, and they were able to go after him for that, and it's just horrible.
So, Laura, do you know if it's permissible in the UK system to use the testimony of other victims against a defendant in this kind of case?
Absolutely. I mean, we actually call it similar fact and bad character. And it's a very important part of lots of different cases, actually. So it is important in sexual assault cases, rape cases, serial rape cases. It's important and it can be used in domestic violence related cases, as well as stalking cases, and as you said, child abuse cases. And it's really important, it gives corroborating information about an abuser, many of whom are serial. And I was going to ask the question again, because obviously we did cover the keepers of Francie, of your reaction to the DA Sharon May in the keepers, who said that it wasn't possible to use, I think you called it similar transaction evidence. Is that the correct terminology in America?
That's the correct terminology where I prosecuted in the state of Georgia. Every state may call it something different. In the federal system, for example, it has letters. It's called 404B evidence because that's the name of the rule that it's listed under that you can use for criminal trials. But I was absolutely appalled, Laura, to listen and watch as Sharon May said the exact wrong and horrifying thing, that she could not prosecute any of the cases because each of the cases had to stand on their own. I mean, ultimately, when you're talking about evidence, of course, each case has to stand on the evidence presented. But when you're talking about the sheer numbers that were involved here, she absolutely had the right to bring in that kind of evidence to, you can't use the legal term bolstering, but as a factual matter, that's what it does, is it bolsters the credibility of the original complainant. And when it comes to actual child evidence, when you have children testifying on the witness stand, one of the really unique and difficult problems I think prosecutors face is that most people are parents or have experience with children, and they understand that children lie about simple things. They lie about things like, did they have that cookie from the cookie jar, when there's crumbs all over their face and they deny it. And so there's a bias by adults against children testifying because those adults know that kids will lie to get themselves out of trouble. And so somehow it makes it easier for a jury to believe they would lie about sexual abuse. And when you have, unfortunately for the children and their credibility, but when you have adults who can say something similar happened to them, it does assist the jury in understanding that that child making that same complaint is probably.
In continuing Laura's question, what about the fact that some crimes are actually a continuing course of conduct? What if somebody committed 7 bank robberies in a row or 7 serial murders in the same jurisdiction? I mean, obviously, the fact that these are all committed by the same person, you can try them for all those cases at once if you want, right?
Well, of course you can. And in the keepers, there was also evidence mentioned about potentially child pornography. That is evidence of someone's sexual interest in children. I've been fighting about this in state and federal court for almost 2 decades, where it's very, Jim and I train about this all the time together, where someone's sexual interest in children is illustrated very strongly when they show that they are interested in child pornography, which are the images of the sexual abuse of children. And so all of that evidence could have and should have been used by Sharon May to prosecute the offenders in those cases. And I am, as a former prosecutor, I was, like Jim, yelling at the television screen, angry at what she had said.
Laura, by the way, in the UK, they have changed the terminology. They've actually changed it to sexual abuse images. I know still in the United States, we officially they still use child pornography, but we do try to talk in those terms here, so to distinguish from sort of entertainment material to criminal, basically a crime scene depicted.
Right. I mean, victims, child victims and others feel very strongly about it is when terms like child prostitute or child pornography is used. It gives the impression that there is consent, which, of course, a child cannot consent. And it would be great to see that sea change in America. I don't know what your views are on that, Francie, and I'll ask you in a second. But so I've certainly worked on serial rape cases where we use similar fact and bad character of breaking down each offense and showing, disaggregating those behaviors and showing clear, stark similarities and differences pointing to it's the same perpetrator. However, the defense will always try and separate out those offenses and will not want them heard together. And that's something that tends to happen in each case and that the prosecution has to fight very hard, or the prosecutor, to ensure that they're heard together. I don't know if you've had experience of that, but I'd certainly like to seek your view on the term child pornography and what your thoughts are on whether that should change in America.
Well, Laura, that's a great point. And there has been a push to change child pornography. It's just in so many laws and so many places that, frankly, I think it's just the complication that is really the only reason that it hasn't been changed. I agree with you completely that it certainly denotes some level of consent from the child, which is completely wrong, which is one of the reasons I get very angry when I see news reports saying things like kiddie porn. That really aggravates me. Because, of course, yeah, that completely minimizes the crime. And then there are other reports all the time, Laura, in a similar vein, where you have reports of teacher in sex romp with student. There's nothing about a teacher sexually assaulting a student that makes it a sex romp. And I am repeatedly offended by that. And it almost always tends to be a female teacher and a male student. And if it was the other way around, I assure you, no news media would be referring to the male teacher assaulting the female student as a sex romp. So I completely agree that language is very important, and we just haven't quite gotten there yet.
Do you think that you will be able to make any inroads? I mean, I know that you were, you gave evidence, didn't you, to U.S. Congress, but I don't know whether any of those debates have been had at that level and whether you've been part of those debates given your previous role.
I did. I testified before the U.S. Congress this spring on a variety of topics related to the sexual abuse of children. That particular issue didn't come up. And I have to say, unfortunately, I feel like we had that debate about 5 years ago. That was when there was a lot of impetus to push for changes in the law. And it just hasn't happened. And I think there's so many other problems dealing with having enough resources to just investigate and prosecute these cases that nobody's really talking in any firm way about changing those terms in the law at this point.
Right. I mean, Jim knows very well CEOP, which is our Child Exploitation Online Protection Command, which is in the National Crime Agency, and it specializes, it has a national and international remit. Looking in particular at online child sex offenders. And it also includes those involved in production, distribution, viewing of child abuse material. And they're very clear, it's child abuse material. And I just wondered, it's a virtual and global task force, and there's just fantastic good practice from Jim's been involved in training various units there. Have you had any involvement with them? And could you tell us how you think the online aspect has changed, crimes against children and prosecuting of these types of cases?
Yeah, I have some experience with them. When I was at the Department of Justice, my job was congressionally mandated. And part of my job was to liaise with all of our federal, state, local, and international partners on trying to fight against child exploitation in all its forms. I did go to Australia and speak to the Virtual Global Task Force in one of their conferences several years ago. And I have very strong feelings on the internet and what it has wrought with respect to child sexual abuse. I'm a firm believer that the internet is great in so many ways. But with respect to the sexual abuse of children, I think that it is a very important factor and driver in the sexual abuse of children, because the sexual abuse images of children are so easy to find on the internet. There are literally millions and millions being transmitted around the world every day, video and still images. And these kinds of images and the community, the sense of community and acceptance that it gives those with a sexual interest in children, drives people to abuse kids.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the sense of community may actually be just as problematic as the ability to transmit and store millions and millions of images and videos. And that is because offenders who know they're being sort of sidelined and they're looked at as pariahs in the community, they're looking for like-minded individuals so that they can rationalize their behavior, so that they can feel like they're not the only ones, that they're not really that bad, and that what they do is not really a crime. And so they try to sort of get together with other people who feel the same way. And it's just never been easier as it is today. In fact, I remember back in the days of internet relay chat when that was really popular, and it's being used again by these offenders. But back in the day, they would come up with a name, a very graphic name about having sex with kids. They'd create their internet relay chat site and then talk about it for a while, share images, do all that kind of stuff, and then disappear. And what it did was it allowed these people to get in touch with each other that would never in a million years have the opportunity to do so. And so that really created an issue for law enforcement, because they would appear and disappear, appear and disappear. And it was a very difficult thing investigatively.
Today, a Polk County teacher accused of having sex with her 17-year-old student is expected to face the wrath of the school board later this morning. A meeting is set for this afternoon. The superintendent is expected to recommend that Jennifer Fichter be fired.
I had a question for you guys. Do you think that maybe these people rationalize that they're really not doing anything wrong because they're not acting upon their pedophilia? They're just looking at images. Obviously, I know that's wrong and that it's not a victimless crime, but that they feel like, well, I'm just looking at these pictures, I'm not doing anything about it. Go.
Well, in fact, Lisa, I have heard that defense many times in the courtroom, where defense attorneys say that the offender was, quote, just looking at images, and that there was no evidence that they had ever physically harmed a child. But all of us professionals who've worked in this, Laura, I'm sure you have this experience too, where you have offenders who are trading child pornography. In one particular case that I presented in Texas recently at the world's largest Crimes Against Children conference there in Dallas, was of a man who began abusing his 5-year-old daughter, because when he was trading the sexual abuse images of children, he no longer had fresh images to trade, so he could no longer receive fresh images. His daughter was there in his complete control and only 5 years old. And so he began abusing her and taking video and still images of it, posting those online and trading them with others so that he could get new material. So we know that child pornography and the trafficking in child pornography absolutely drives the sexual abuse of children. And he was part of an investigation that was global, where there were groups who were teaching each other how to abuse children, how to defeat law enforcement, using encryption so that law enforcement couldn't find the sites that they were speaking on. So, yes, Jim is absolutely right. The community, I think, is one of the most dangerous factors here.
Right, and they're creating a market. They're creating a market that they have to have endless product for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these children are being victimized, and the images are actually a crime itself. Creating the image is a crime itself. So you're creating basically a crime scene with every one of those images. and it's contraband itself. So it's no different than possessing cocaine or another, you know, illegal drug. It is a crime to have it. It's a crime to make it. It's a crime to share it and distribute it. And obviously, it's a crime to put your hands on a child in any sexual way or to depict them in a sexual way, even if they're not naked or they're not being touched. It's still child sex crimes images if they are done for a sexual purpose.
That's absolutely right. In fact, the federal definition for child pornography includes lewd and lascivious display, and that can be a child fully clothed but considered to be lasciviously and lewdly displaying the genital area in a way that might, quote, arouse the sexual desire of a viewer. Right. And I have prosecuted those cases where you did not, fortunately for the child, necessarily have nude images, but it was still a sexual picture.
Right. And the other thing that people don't realize is that if a child is in the image and an adult is also in the image or another child is in the image, and that child or adult is engaging in sexual activity, and this child is in that same image, it's also child pornography or child sexual abuse image. And so that can be prosecuted as well.
You know, we've talked a little bit about some of the challenges with prosecuting the cases. What's some of the good practice in your experience of prosecuting these quite challenging cases?
Well, Laura, oftentimes you have in this case a single witness who is the one who was party to the crime. That is the victim, the child who has been abused. And so as a prosecutor, you have to find more than that. You have to make sure, it's your job to make sure that a jury understands what has happened to this child. And so best practices include things like verifying some of the things the child said. Was the child able to give any kind of date range, which they sometimes can and sometimes can't? Was the child able to describe the place where the abuse happened? And in that case, you go to the scene and you take photographs documenting that the child was accurate when describing the bedspread or what's on the wall. What about the movements of the offender? When the child says this happened after school every day, was the offender working? Can you prove the offender actually did have the opportunity to abuse the child? And then one of the key witnesses in almost every child sexual abuse case I ever prosecuted was someone from a local child advocacy center. Here in the U.S., we have local child advocacy centers who assist in these kinds of cases by providing a central location where children can be interviewed once instead of multiple times by multiple agencies, and potentially treated, even given a medical exam, and then treated mental health-wise for free at these advocacy centers. And having the specialists at the advocacy center, the social workers, the LCSWs, the masters, the people who are doctors of psychology or psychiatry, to come and talk to the jury and educate them about how children disclose abuse and whether or not the child's disclosures are consistent with other disclosures by children. That evidence became absolutely key in almost, gosh, Laura, maybe 98% of the cases I ever prosecuted, because otherwise I had the child and their word.
Having other, I guess, you know, it's the same with domestic violence and stalking, having other experts as well who can educate the court and the jury about child sex abuse and, you know, the online world and the offline world.
Absolutely true. I mean, having that other evidence is critically important. And it brings up another great point, and that is resources. I mean, I was very lucky to prosecute these kinds of cases in offices and jurisdictions that had access to things like child advocacy centers. But there are only a few hundred around the country, and there are hundreds of thousands of children being abused every year. And so the system is overwhelmed, and many prosecutors in many places sadly do not have access to those kinds of experts who can come in and testify. And it's something that needs to be remedied. And that, Laura, to your earlier point, was one of the things I talked to Congress about this spring, was providing more resources for child advocacy centers and to build new child advocacy centers around the country to have those resources available.
Yeah, and one of the benchmark child advocacy centers is the Stewart House in Los Angeles. It's actually located in Santa Monica, and it is part of the LA Rape Treatment Center. And I believe it may be the first child advocacy center that was created in the United States, and it's amazing. And I know that Gail Abagnale, who founded it, she has been amazing at raising money. She raised all the money to build it. They have five active detectives who work out of that advocacy center, as well as five prosecutors and therapists, and they're attached right to a hospital right nearby where they can get all the evaluations done, and everything is done in such an amazing way. Just like they do with adult victims of rape and sexual assault, they have special people set up who are trained to do this, who are trained to interview child interview specialists, as well as pediatricians who are trained in evaluating children for sex crimes, and nurses and nurse practitioners who help. It's really an amazing program, and I wish that everybody had somebody like Gail who could raise that kind of money for them. And I hope that people will consider donating to your local child advocacy centers, because I believe they are incredibly important in the fight and against child sex crimes, and as well as protecting children from this kind of abuse.
I was just going to say, Jim, that I get emails all the time from people wanting to help, not knowing how to help. And it seems to me there's a two-prong approach that you've mentioned. Is one is getting the government to be more involved. Even if you're a little government kind of person, you know, talking to your local officials and saying, demanding that they address this need in your community. And alternatively, going a grassroots approach and volunteering somewhere, finding that Stewart House in your community or making it, because it doesn't have to be a huge program. It's these little programs, you know, these little pinpoints of light that can make a huge, huge difference.
Well, it can, Lisa. And in fact, my own hometown, where I was prosecuting many of these cases, has an advocacy center called Safe Path Advocacy, Child Advocacy Center. And they did the exact same thing. There is one woman, Ginger Robbins, who is solely responsible for putting it together, fundraising every year. And that's a major part of what she has to do. And she is a licensed social worker herself. I had her testify in the witness stand many times. But she has to worry about funding that advocacy center that sees hundreds and thousands of children year in and year out, and has for 20 years. And that's a great point that people, if they want to know where to volunteer, find your local child advocacy center. And if you don't have one, spearhead an effort to get one. And then there's the National Children's Alliance. They're the organization that certifies or licenses most of the child advocacy centers around the country. And the Department of Justice provides them with a good amount of funding, but it is not nearly enough for the hundreds of advocacy centers around the country.
Right. In fact, that's where Francie and I met, was when I was speaking, telling my story to help try to raise money for a child advocacy center in
South Carolina.
But it was a child advocacy center that was struggling to keep its doors open and to deal with the influx of child victims that were coming through their doors. And I had done another one right after that in a more rural area that was having even more trouble raising any money to help keep their doors open. And it's just sad that these people who are dedicated, they want to help, but they have no funding.
And you don't have to have an MSW or be in law enforcement to help either. That's what our listener Anna was asking. She's a total non-expert. She just reach out. You will find your path if you really want to. And even a non-expert like me can make a big difference to some of these organizations.
Well, and these kids need items. For example, at Safe Path, kids will be taken out of the home because they're at risk, and they're brought oftentimes in the middle of the night to the child advocacy center. They don't have a toothbrush. So the child advocacy center has to provide clothing, items that they can use to wash, combs, brushes, shampoo, water, snacks for the kids that are there waiting to be treated or seen for interviews. All of these things any volunteer could provide to their local advocacy center and make a tremendous difference.
Yeah, it's the little things that make the biggest difference to those who are in refuges, or whether they're at, we have havens, so they're sexual assault referral centers that all ages can go to, and they are actually government funded, but it's a one-stop shop. So you'll see the paediatrician there, you know, the counsellor, everybody will be there. But like I said, there's a number of them across the country. I was actually involved in setting up one of the first ones in London, which is in Camberwell, and giving victims choices that some of them, they could report to the police or they could have their forensics taken and frozen. But we gave victims lots of different choices. And I think that's a very important part to the recovery process as well. And then, of course, you know, linking serial perpetrators is quite important. So I think, yeah, grassroots organisations are great. I certainly know from having set up, you know, Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service, fundraising is such a challenge. You know, I'm there, I'm not quite shaking the tin, but writing funding apps and, you know, you have to do it all. And it's a real challenge for those people who are trying to change making communities and ensure that there are support services for victims. But there's also the prevention part, isn't there? And, you know, we need to talk to children about sex and relationships and also about the internet, because social media has really changed the way young people communicate. And of course, it opens the whole door for predators and perpetrators as well. So there's dual conversations that need to go on, aren't there, in terms of trying to keep people safe and get into intervention and prevention. And I think CEOP, you know, are world leaders around their Think You Know campaigns. I don't know if any of you have seen them. I certainly, you know, always put them up and post them online, and we post them via Paladin, because it's all about how you have the conversation with children. And of course, we can't always talk about not talking to strangers, as we've discussed before, you know, and it's trying to educate people and young people at the same time with age appropriate information. I don't know if you can say anything about that, Francie.
Well, Laura, that's a great point, too. I mean, there's lots of training that needs to be done around the country, and I'll be going to a school fairly soon. I was asked to come and train the teachers and staff and coaches about what to look for, because we all know that people who are sexually interested in children are most likely to be employed in places where there are children available to target. But what I told this particular administrator was that I could not recommend more strongly that I also be allowed the opportunity to train the children, because they are their first best defense against sexual exploitation. And they've actually extended my training another day so that I can talk to the children, because they too need to understand in an age-appropriate way, and it's always different for elementary school kids versus middle school kids versus high school kids, but they need to understand that there are people out there who might want to hurt them, what they can do, what they should do. And sadly, Laura, I have never done that kind of training without at least one child coming up to me afterward and telling me about abuse that was either ongoing or that had happened in their past and that they had never told anyone before, and they wanted to ask me what they should do. And of course, I've had to refer them for lots of services into law enforcement. But
thank goodness you were, you know, opening that conversation and they creating a safe space for them to disclose. Thank you for doing that.
And that one, thank you, Laura, but that's exactly what happens, is that there's so many of these children never get any information about it, and they don't know what to do. Jim likes to say that you'd never let your child walk outside and cross the street without telling them that there are cars out there and they should look both ways before they cross. And why aren't we giving our kids the same kind of information about those who might abuse them?
You do teach your children how to cross the street, but you don't teach them that there's somebody in a car that wants to run them down. And so sometimes maybe that's what holds parents back, and it's so hard for them to explore.
But you do also teach them that there are people who get drunk and drive recklessly, and there are people that are texting, and so they drive right through stop signs and red lights. And so it's a danger. And whether, you don't have to give them a negative feeling about it, you can still be protecting them. Mm-hmm. When we had Joelle Castaic on and her book, The Well-Armed Child, she talks about how parents can actually empower children. Knowledge is power. And I think it's all in how you present it and how early you start to present it that actually makes it easier for parents. So But it's something that, you know, Francie and I and Laura, I'm sure in your area of expertise as well, you have to sort of really fight a system that kind of wants to just not talk about it. It's a difficult thing, and that's not healthy for potential victims. It's actually setting them up, in my mind.
No, and that's one of the things I used to say as a state prosecutor, was that the hardest part of my job wasn't convincing a jury that the guy sitting in the box had sexually abused the child, but that anybody had sexually abused the child. Just convincing the jury first, it was always a two-step process. Someone abused this child, and yes, I can prove that person is the one who did it. No other crime requires that kind of two-step process.
We went to the cemetery, and as it turned out, it was a bright, sunny day, and I had recently bought a red convertible, so I rode there with my top down, you know, because this is just, I mean, we were going to find such great evidence, okay? So I was pumped up for that. To my recollection, there was nothing found that went right to, oh, Maskell molested these kids.
Can I ask you guys, I have some listener questions I'd love to fire at you guys before we sign off.
Fire away.
All right. Well, since we brought up the wonderful Sharon May, so Billy in Baltimore, I'm a big fan of the podcast, blah, blah, blah. Well, listening to today's episode, I totally understand the outrage at Sharon May. Her smug demeanor in the interview and arrogance was apparent, but I'm surprised that no one on your show raised the possibility that she was intimidated and threatened by the police and the archdiocese, and that her behavior and excuses are a defense mechanism and somehow a coping mechanism for guilt for not handling the cases differently. He brings up how the police, you know, there was a deep throat who was scared to come forward, but maybe Miss May was also in fearful of her life or the lives of her family members if she was more aggressive in prosecuting the case. What do you guys say to that?
You know, as a public prosecutor, every place I worked, I raised my hand and took an oath. And that oath was to do justice. That oath was to do justice without fear or favor. That's literally in the oath. And I do not care if she was threatened by anybody. Her job is to do justice without fear or favor. And so while I suppose there was some possibility that she was intimidated or under threat, that is absolutely categorically not an excuse for failing not just to do her job, but failing to get any kind of justice for all those survivors and to protect future potential victims.
And also, we ask kids and victims to come forward, and they don't have the knowledge or the position or the authority of the justice system behind her. Sharon May did. She was the actual justice system in this case. She was the wall that was put up to prevent them from actually moving forward. She said that she didn't quite get the cooperation she wanted from the Catholic Church, but that didn't at all make her want to go forward. It made her just recede and just abdicate her responsibility. So I put a tremendous amount of weight on her and a tremendous amount of guilt on her for this case, those cases not being prosecuted and those victims never finding justice.
Yeah, and to weigh in here, I have to say I didn't get a sense that she was intimidated by the way that she presented. And she actually said that she wasn't intimidated. And she goes into this kind of almost passive-aggressive mode when she's challenged around it. And I felt there was quite a lot of swag actually coming off of her and, you know, her being quite passive aggressive with it. And so I didn't get that sense at all. And it is her duty and her responsibility in that office. I mean, she was the DA. And so that wasn't the sense that I got from that interview. So I'm afraid she really pissed me off, you know, case itself when she started talking about that red convertible.
But she could have just resigned if she was so terrified of the Catholic Church.
Right, and let somebody else who actually wanted to do their job. What other questions do you have for us?
Okay,
from
so
our wonderful listeners.
So real quick, this is from Jesse. So Jim talked about to whom law enforcement can go to get extra help with child sex abuse cases. But could you talk a little bit about who a regular citizen should turn to if you have allegations, suspicions, and they're being ignored? And if there's a similar case in the Keepers where, you know, you take it up to the authorities, you even take it to the police, and it doesn't seem like anything is being done. They just move the predator around. You know, what do you do? Contact the FBI. What do you do?
Well, first of all, you can contact the state police. If you're in a city, you can probably contact the county police and the state police. And if you believe that the police are actually covering it up, that's a federal violation, and you can contact the FBI. Or if the victimization crosses state lines or uses an interstate facility, for example, the internet, then that is also a federal crime, so you can contact the FBI. There are also amazing organizations like StopItNow.org, SafeForAthletes.org, and MaleSurvivor.org. And all those organizations are set up to help people deal with situations. They will tell you what resources are available in the area. And if you're lucky enough to have a child advocacy center in your area, you can contact them as well. If you're not lucky enough to have that, call the local hospital, call the local your mayor, your state legislators. Tell people, write letters. Don't stop making noise until you get justice.
Well, that's such a great point, Jim. And I have a case that illustrated exactly that kind of persistence level that sometimes, unfortunately, is necessary. We had a case of a child who was kidnapped, sexually assaulted in a very violent way, strangled and left for dead and buried under leaves and twigs when she was just 5 years old. She fortunately survived that assault and was able to astoundingly give a composite drawing of her kidnapper attacker to the police. Well, when the police put that out over the media, there was one man who recognized that composite. He called the police station and was told, that's not our case. You need to probably call Crimes Against Persons. And they just hung up on him. So we called Crimes Against Persons, and Crimes Against Persons said, that's not really our case. Maybe you should try Crimes Against Children. He called Crimes Against Children and couldn't get through the first time. And they said, I'm not really sure whose case it is. Could you call back tomorrow? We need to know who the assigned detective is.
Unbelievable.
This is a man who kidnapped and left for dead a 5-year-old girl. So he made that fourth call to Crimes Against Children and finally got to the right detective. And it was literally only because of him identifying the perpetrator, who was a stranger to the child, that man was eventually brought in, charged, tried, and convicted. So persistence is unfortunately necessary sometimes.
My goodness. I mean, just to say, in the UK, we have Childline. You know, if someone's a child that's suffering, then there's Childline and then the NSPCC. Both organizations you can volunteer for if people were interested in that. But we also have Crime Stoppers too, which is an anonymous sort of tip line that people can call. And when people call in, the things that are said are analyzed, then you would hope that things would be progressed if there were repeat patterns or names passed. And, you know, the other part, just to add to what Francie and Jim said, is obviously, you know, like Ryan White did, do the documentary style, expose a different way and bring attention to the issue, and don't stop, as Francie said, keep going.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear things like that, I just realize that, you know, the people that work in law enforcement, in the justice system, in the medical systems, they have to have the drive to want to help all the time. I mean, I remember when I was working a child abduction case in Gary, Indiana, and I called up because there was a burn issue in it, and I called up the Burns Center at Chicago General Hospital, and to try to ask them about, to have them look at a picture to tell us what they thought was the source of these burns. And literally, the person said, "We don't do that," and they hung up the phone on me. And I called back 3 times and got the same response. And I was just disgusted by that. It was a 2-year-old who was murdered, and they didn't have the damn decency to give a damn at all.
We just have to remember that not everyone is as motivated, driven, or as committed you know, as we and some of our colleagues are. And, you know, keeping people motivated in some of these areas can be really tough because it's really toxic, difficult subject matter, material that you're exposed to. And that's where, you know, vicarious trauma and so on can set in. So you have to make sure there is the right supervision and clinical supervision. I do believe that people that join law enforcement in certain professions, prosecuting, you know, charity work, you want to help people, but burnout can be high. But it, you know, it's unacceptable that someone has to call twice, let alone three times or four times or five times. And when people don't do their jobs, then they should be held to account without.
Absolutely. As we're wrapping up, I just kind of want to end on a more positive note, maybe. Yeah. Can you just talk about something that went right? I mean, talk about something that somebody stopped something terrible from happening, and maybe just a Joe Schmo like me or a Jane Schmo like me, you know, that the individual can make a difference. Can you think of something like that?
Well, sure. I mean, there's a great example of an effort globally by law enforcement in a particular case that it's not a feel-good case. It was a terrible child abuse case that was discovered by the Australians. It was some online images they'd never seen before, and they were so concerned for the safety of the child that they immediately dropped everything they were doing to try to find her. It took almost 2 years and literally an effort by global law enforcement, 20 different agencies around the world, multiple agencies inside the United States, all looking for this one child because she was so at risk. And it took 2 years, but it took the efforts of a local agent in the Maine State Police named Dawn Ego. She's an analyst, not a sworn law enforcement officer, but an analyst who looked at these terrible images of the child and said to herself, I'm going to find her. And she made it her work for weeks and weeks and weeks to track down all of the things inside the image. And that did eventually lead to finding, rescuing this child, getting her out of the terrible atmosphere that she was in, bringing the offender to justice. And while global law enforcement was involved, it was really the work of one analyst who rescued that child.
That's okay. Great. And, you know, a big up to the analyst community. Having come from that community as a criminal behavioral analyst and intelligence analyst, you know, they do incredible work and they don't get acknowledged. And in that case, you know, did something incredible, and many analysts do. So I just want to give a shout out to the unsung heroes of the analyst community. There's many of you out there, and I know you listen to Real Crime Profile.
That's great. And what a great uplifting note to end on. Thank you so much, Francie, for coming in and talking with us on Real Crime Profile. And thank you, Laura and Lisa. And we've had an amazing run talking about these cases and the relationship to the documentary series, The Keepers. And we hope that you will watch that series and make some noise about it. Get angry and do something. And if you have any inkling that this is going on in your neighborhood or your schools or your clubs or your sports or your family even, say something about it, do something, protect a child. Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247.
In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.